Our strategy is
that we assume the existence of a suitable potential, V of phi, for a scalar field. So we assume that there exists a scalar field, which we will call the inflaton field, and we assume that the action of the scalar field includes some potential V of phi. Of course, there is research out there that tries to reduce those assumptions. For example, Robert Broad is suggesting that phi is really not a fundamental field, but it's a density of degrees of freedom that are left over after a cutoff. And there are also ideas about what the potential could be of that field phi. But for now, for us, for our purposes, let's just buy into those assumptions. There exists a scalar field phi, a real scalar field phi, with a potential V of phi, for example, of that type. And we assume suitable initial conditions, perhaps arising through a quantum fluctuation, as we discussed in the last lecture. So in that case, when still everything is done classically, we have a solution. We can find solutions to the two equations of motion, the Einstein equation and the Klein-Gödel equation. We assume that all other fields don't contribute much. The other fields don't have enough energy momentum to disturb what the Klein-Gödel field and gravity are doing together. So we have two equations of motion, the Einstein equation and the Klein-Gödel equation. We have two things, 2 degrees of freedom that we wonder about, namely the Klein-Gödel field and the scale factor. Everything is still classical, and everything is still homogeneous in space. The homogeneity would be a consequence of our initial conditions that have led to an expansion of space-time. So with these assumptions, we can actually calculate what phi naught of t and a naught of t are going to be during a period of slow roll inflation. An inflationary period that lasts from an initial time ti to a final time tf, or in conformal time coordinates, from eta I to eta f. So far, that's all classical. And even this classical picture of inflation explains several open questions that Big Bang cosmology had, such as why would the universe be so flat? Well, if we have an inflationary period, then everything would be inflated to the extent that whatever was not flat at the beginning would end up being looking pretty much flat. But then inflation can also provide us with an explanation for the origin of the inhomogeneities in the universe. And for that purpose, we now introduce in our so far classical and homogeneous calculations also inhomogeneities. So we say that the inflaton field is the spatially homogeneous inflaton field with a large amplitude, perhaps, you know, could be of large amplitude, plus a perturbation, a contribution to the inflaton field, which we allow to be both space and time dependent. But we assume that its amplitude is small compared to the bulk of the inflaton field, to what we may also call the zero mode, because it's the 0k degree of freedom of the field. Our strategy will be to quantize this part. Now, by allowing fluctuations in the inflaton field, spatial fluctuations in the inflaton field, we must also consider small fluctuations in the metric. That's because if we calculate the energy momentum tensor that corresponds to an inflaton field like that, then since phi is going to be spatially inhomogeneous, then also the energy momentum tensor will fluctuate in space. But the energy momentum tensor is on the right-hand side of the Einstein equation. So if that is space-dependent, then the left-hand side must also be space-dependent. Therefore, curvature must also be space-dependent for consistency. So in order to do a self-consistent calculation, we must also consider small fluctuations in the metric, therefore. So as I said before, we are assuming here that in the very early universe, the main contribution to the energy momentum tensor came from the Klein-Gordon field. So that we can write the energy momentum tensor in this way. And then, as I just said, if the phi have non-trivial space derivatives, then that will show up in the energy momentum tensor. It will be space dependent as well. The energy momentum tensor is on the right-hand side. Space dependent, so the left-hand side has to be space dependent. And therefore, inhomogeneities in phi induce inhomogeneities in G mu nu. You may even view this the other way around. I mean, who's to say that the right-hand side is causing the left-hand side? You could also say that inhomogeneities in this cause inhomogeneities in that. So in any case, we will have to consider small inhomogeneities in the metric as well. So we write the metric tensor now as the unperturbed homogeneous metric tensor, which is just the metric tensor of Minkowski space with a conformal prefactor. Remember, this is what we can do when we use co-moving coordinates and the conformal time variable. The purpose of this coordinate system was that we are able to pull the scale factor in front of everything. That's why it's called conformal. So this is the metric for a homogeneous space-time that's expanding. And now we allow a space and time-dependent perturbation of that metric. Again, we assume that these perturbations are small. Now, at this point, the purists should really start worrying because, you know, this is a tensor. And if it's non-zero, you can make its entries very, very large, very, very small, simply by changing coordinate system. So really, it's a non-trivial issue to say that these perturbations are small. So we have to be very careful in this. And for practical purposes, you can assume for the moment that you choose a coordinate system, like the conformal coordinate system, and then you assume this to be numerically small. But really, when you work with a generic spacetime that has inhomogeneities, there is no generic coordinate system for it. And then you see it's not trivial to make sense of this. If you have a generic expanding spacetime with inhomogeneities, what is this slicing of spacetime into space-like hypersurfaces for which this is the lowest order? You can do different slicings, and we will soon see that this matters. So now, in principle, we would like to solve the full quantum theory of both the metric tensor and the inflaton field. We would like to put hats on everything and just solve everything. But that is just not possible. It's too hard. So what we do is perturbation theory. And to lowest order in the perturbation theory, we find the classical solutions first. So we're looking for the zero mode, for the homogeneous part of the metric, solve that along with the equation for the zero mode of the inflaton field. This obeys the classical Klein-Gordon equation. This obeys the classical Einstein equation. We assume homogeneity as we did before. We get the usual solution, the same solution that we had before. But then we try to do the full quantum theory of the perturbations, of the perturbation of the inflaton field and the perturbation of the metric. Why does that approximation help? Why isn't that just as hard as solving the full problem? Why does it help that we can assume now that those perturbations are small? I mean, other than that, what have we gained? We still have to solve some sort of Klein-Gordon equation, some sort of Einstein equation for these. Why would we expect that we can do the quantum theory of those two when we couldn't do the quantum theory of the full metric and the full inflaton field? Well, for fields phi and gamma that are small, the equations of motion become effectively linear. That's the main part. The Einstein equation is hard to quantize because it's highly nonlinear. Imagine how the metric enters into the Einstein equation in very complicated ways, nonlinear ways too. And that's why it's so hard to quantize.
How does it become linear?
Well, no, yeah, you haven't seen it. Yeah, Taylor expansion. Yeah. You haven't seen it just yet. I'm just predicting that this is what will happen. And roughly, this is because when we make the assumption that these are small, then we can do an expansion of the action, assuming that their equations of that in there, so that only the quadratic terms are left in the action, which means that the equations of motion will contain only linear terms. You see, if you have a small quantity, then the square of it will be even smaller, the third power even smaller, and so on. And we may truncate the series as soon as it gets too hard for us, which is the third power. Of course, this is only legal if these things really come out small at the end. Otherwise, we've made a mistake. Or we've just have a very bad approximation. Now, if we only go in the Taylor expansion of the action to the quadratic terms, this means that the quantum fields phi and gamma hat, since they now have only quadratic terms in the action, have no potential terms. And they may not even have mass terms. Well, they could, but they will not. So in fact, what we will find is a free, that is a non-interacting quantum field theory, whose only non-triviality comes from the time-varying, from the fact that the parameters are time-varying. But you see the parameters now in this theory for the perturbation phi and the perturbation gamma of the metric, the parameters that enter into their equations of motion are not just omega k of t, but also the background phi naught of eta and the background a naught of eta, which, of course, are just functions of omega of t.
Mm-hmm. Why do we have no potential terms? Is it because that's made of, you know, phi squared and phi to the fourth? Or
yeah, potential terms would be like phi to the third, phi to the fourth, and so on. We just truncated earlier. It's not that we throw away the potential, really, because this thing evolves according to the full potential. It's just that the perturbation doesn't see it. So now, here's an intuition. We should expect that there are two more sources of non-triviality. Even though everything becomes linear, the equations of motion will then become linear. So if the actions are quadratic, the equations of motion are linear, because the Euler-Lagrange equations involve first derivatives. So we should still expect two more sources of non-triviality. First of all, because of the interdependence of the perturbation of the inflaton field and the perturbation of the metric. Remember that it would not be consistent to have only the inflaton field fluctuate and not the metric, because they're coupled to the Einstein equation. And vice versa, having only gamma fluctuate wouldn't be consistent because via the Einstein equation it's coupled to the phi. But that means that really much of the inhomogeneities, much of the fluctuations of gamma, or maybe all of it, will not be an independent fluctuation. It will be induced by the inhomogeneities of the inflaton. So we shouldn't think of phi and gamma as being independent degrees of freedom that need to be quantized independently. And, well, I already mentioned that vice versa. We can also read the Einstein equation from left to right, which is to say that gravity fluctuations, inhomogeneities in the gravity, induce inhomogeneities in the inflaton field. So we'll have to disentangle the degrees of freedom there. We'll have to see what are really independent degrees of freedom and what may be coupled. Mm-hmm.
I don't understand the word quantum.
Well, the thing is that the inflaton field has only one degree of freedom. It's just one amplitude. The metric is a priori a 4x4 matrix. Sure, it's symmetric and so on, but it's clear it could have more degrees of freedom than one. And it's a non-trivial issue how many degrees of freedom the metric has, because, first of all, it looks like a 4x4 matrix, but then it has to be symmetric. That gets rid of a lot of them. But then also, you can choose coordinate system in clever ways and then ensure that some matrix elements are zero, but not all of them. So before we know what are the degrees of freedom in the metric, we can't really say how much of it. In principle, we should expect that some of the degrees of freedom of the metric will be coupled to the Einstein equation to the inflaton field, and some others may not. And this is what will turn out. Some will be coupled, some will not. Okay, so the first source of non-triviality, even though everything is in terms of linear equations of motion now for the perturbations, first source of non-triviality is that the phi and the gamma are not completely independent. But then the second issue to consider is that indeed some of the gamma is independent of phi. And to see this, consider that gravity is a force much like electromagnetism. You see, some of electromagnetism, some electromagnetic fields only exist because there are charges or currents that make them on the spot. And if you take away those charges or currents, then the field is gone. But on the other hand, electromagnetic fields can also be self-sustaining. There exist electromagnetic fields that are there, even though there may not be any charges or currents anywhere near to them. And these would be electromagnetic waves. It's the case where an electric field that decays is inducing a magnetic field. A magnetic field that decays is inducing an electric field. So the electric field is a source for the magnetic field, the magnetic field is a source for the electric field, and in this way you have propagating waves. These are the homogeneous solutions to the Maxwell equations. The homogeneous ones have on the right-hand side currents and charges. And you can always decompose your solutions into a homogeneous solution plus an inhomogeneous solution. Concretely, consider a vector field E of x, like the electric field. It can always be decomposed into what might be called a scalar part of the electric field and a vector part of the electric field.
So would the vector part be analogous to the well measure?
Exactly, that's what I'm aiming at.
Okay.
Exactly. The point is that in gravity too, you can have self-sustaining waves of gravity, gravity waves. They can exist even when there's no matter. They can propagate even through empty space. And that indicates to us that even though the metric is coupled through the Einstein equation to the inflaton field, we shouldn't expect that all degrees of freedom of the metric are coupled through the Einstein equation to the inflaton field. The metric should also have completely independent degrees of freedom that will fluctuate on their own and not care about the matter. And these would be degrees of freedom that correspond to gravitational waves. Now, in order to see how to separate those degrees of freedom in the case of gravity, let's see how we separate those two degrees of freedom, the ones that couple two sources, such as matter or charges, how we decouple those from degrees of freedom that can propagate on their own. So in the case of electromagnetism, we can take, for example, the electric field and decompose it in what we may call a scalar part of it and a vector part. Now, you may wonder, well, wait a moment, it's a vector field anyway, so how can it have a scalar part? Well, it can have a scalar part in the sense that there are vector fields which are simply derivatives of scalar functions. They're simply gradients of a scalar function. So therefore, all the information about the vector field is contained in a scalar function. And indeed, every vector field can be decomposed in this way. It's a gradient field plus the rest. The rest is what also is called curl part, or the vector part. So ES is the gradient of a scalar function, and EV, the curl part, the vector part of the vector field, is the curl of some other vector field. And they obey that the curl of the vector part, the curl of the gradient is zero, and on the other hand, the divergence of the vector part is also zero. A very similar decomposition is possible for the metric fluctuations. We should again expect a decomposition where we have, in this case, the metric on the left-hand side, and then we would have the metric or the metric fluctuation decomposed into a part that is simply derivative of a scalar plus, well, it's a two-tensor now for the metric, so we would have second derivatives of a scalar plus first derivatives of a vector plus the rest. And then we should have conditions or properties of those scalar, vector, and remaining parts that obey conditions just like that. You see, the vector field is a tensor of rank 1. That's just one index. And so we have only a decomposition in two pieces. First derivative of a scalar plus a true vector. But when we have two indices here, then we would have two derivatives of a scalar plus one derivative of a vector plus the rest. Okay, now according to the Maxwell equations, still completing the picture of the electromagnetism, according to the Maxwell equations, the scalar part, for example, of the electric field E, is caused by or causes the electric charge density. We have that the divergence of E is the charge density. While the vector part is charge independent. See, the curl of E, the second contribution to the electric field, this thing here, this contribution here, is not sensitive to the presence of a charge. And what it is this. It's induced when the B field decays. And the B field obeys a very similar decomposition and equations. So this is the reason why you can decompose electric fields into electromagnetic fields into contributions that are caused by charges and currents and into contributions that induce each other and lead to traveling waves that don't need any charges or currents. But let's not focus too much on the electromagnetic case because we'll do it in detail for the gravitational case. In gravity, similarly, some curvature exists only where there's energy momentum, and some curvature can exist also where there's no matter or energy or momentum. And that would be gravitational waves. Strictly speaking, the decomposition is not everything would be called gravitational wave. But roughly speaking, this is what they are in general. Can you see why there would be solutions to the Einstein equations where you don't have matter or energy around, and still the curvature is non-trivial, and it's not a gravitational wave? Well, yes, but just think of the Schwarzschild solution, for example. It is a vacuum solution, right? So it has curvature and everything, even though there's no energy and momentum outside the singularity. So it's a vacuum solution, but it's not, you wouldn't call that a gravitational wave. But it's similar with electromagnetism, right? You have a charge sitting there, and it has a Kuhnau field around it as well. Okay. So it's a bit simplifying to just call everything that's a homogeneous solution a gravitational wave, or generally a wave. Now, so what we the conclusion overall is that we should expect that the perturbation of the metric contains some curvature that is induced or induces by the inflaton by its inhomogeneities, and some curvature which is self-sustaining, some fluctuations that have completely their own dynamics and are not sensitive to the quantum fluctuations of the inflaton field. How to separate those two mathematically? Well, similarly to vector fields, we now do a decomposition for the tensor field gamma. The perturbations, gamma mu nu, are of three types. Gamma consists of one part, which is obtained by doing second derivatives of a scalar function. If you take a scalar function and you do two covariant derivatives, one with index mu, one with index nu, you get a symmetric two tensor. So some part of gamma mu nu might be of that type. Then you could also have a part of gamma mu nu, which is the first covariant derivative of a vector field. If you symmetrize that, you also get a symmetric tensor.
Of the field, which is self-sustained, is the one which propagates and carries energy with it?
No, yes, if you think about the self-sustaining, yes, in that case. But think of the Kuhnhoff field is not propagating. It's still, or the Schwarzschild solution. It's not propagating.
Yeah, but it doesn't transport energy with it either.
Right. You see, I just... I regret raising that issue there. I put this thing with the traveling waves as a picture there, right? Because in many cases, this is what you have. But the clean thing to do is really to do the mathematical decomposition, and then you can interpret what you get in detail. Okay. So the mathematical strategy is this. We have a two-tensor gamma mu nu, and it's going to consist of three contributions in general. One part of it can be written as the second covariant derivative of a scalar function. That's case A. Another part of it can be written as the first covariant derivative of a vector function. And then there's going to be a rest. Something left over that cannot be written as any derivative of anything scalar or vector. Something that's really purely tensor.
That confused me because before with left field, we had two parts and both were first derivatives.
No, actually, only the first was a... if you remember.
One was a divergence, one was a gradient, one was a curl. Both of those are...
No. You see, this is the first derivative of a scalar, and that is the rest.
Oh, okay.
So the derivative of anything, right? Well, in this case, it is the curl of another vector field, but that's not the first derivative of anything. It just happens to be the case that this can be written in this way. We didn't plan it that way. And here we do it in four dimensions in which you don't have the curl.
You say that it's not a derivative because it doesn't follow the Leibniz. But
No, that's not quite right, because the axial derivative, the curl in three dimensions is the axial derivative. So it just happens to be the case that in three dimensions the curl is the axial derivative.
So why is
and
it?
And so, no, it just happens to be so in three dimensions, but it wouldn't be four. So now we have decomposition then of d mu nu, just spelling out what I said in words before. The invariant length, the invariant distance, is expressed in terms of the metric in this way, of course. So, you know, dx mu is just some little distance. I could, of course, also write down the metric now as a 4x4 matrix, but I'm writing down fairly big metrics here, and if I were to write them as 4x4 matrices, then it would be rather messy. So I'm writing it down in this way. The invariant length squared is the contraction of the metric tensor with this thing, where dx mu is just some infinitesimal distance. It's just a definition of what the invariant distance is. Then what we do here is we decompose the metric into the zero mode of the metric, which is the part that only depends on time, not on space. It's the G0 mu nu that we had before. It's the thing that we don't quantize. It's the thing that obeys the classical Einstein equation together with the zero mode of the inflaton field. And the rest. So ds squared is the invariant distance with respect to the metric of the zero mode. That's the metric of the zero mode. It's the usual Minkowski metric times the scale factor squared here. Okay. And then we have the invariant distances that arise from the scalar part of the metric, the vector part of the metric, and the tensor part of the metric. I just gave them names here, so I don't have to spell out those huge 4x4 matrices. Let us look at these things separately. What would be the scalar part of the metric? It's going to be some 4x4 matrix that can be obtained by suitable derivatives. So the scalar part of the metric is anything and everything that can be obtained by two by up to two derivatives here. We are also allowing for some the precise statement is that the scalar part of the metric is anything and everything in the metric that can be written in terms of scalar functions, be it by differentiating twice or by just writing down those functions here. It could be without a derivative or with the first derivative. You see, we are doing all of this with respect to the spatial derivatives, right? So as far as time is concerned, we don't have the time derivatives in this. We are decomposing at every point in time.
Why the time?
Why a delta sign?
Delta I j.
I don't know.
The second line.
Second line? Oh, this one?
Yeah.
Okay, but it's just a scalar function, and you need those delta I j to get a scalar. Right?
No, but I mean, you could contract it with some other I j also. By right? Delta.
I don't know what you mean by that.
Like you could contract it with some chi ij, which is not delta ij.
You could contract it with what?
Some other arbitrary tensor, say chi ij.
What are you contracting here? Chi doesn't have anything.
Yeah. No, you just...
You see, you always have two of those differentials there.
Yeah.
Okay? So... in this thing here, you have to contract those i's and the j's.
Because delta i j.
The scalar function times this, that's giving you a scalar that contracts those two indices, right? And then you have the second derivative of e as well. And in principle, you could have, let's say, a first derivative and then a vector field here. But that is going to be in the next category. Because it's not something made out of scalars. You see, phi scalar, b scalar.
No, what I'm saying is delta is here the Kronecker delta. Right?
It is a Kronecker delta.
Then it would just put I is equal to j, and when you sum over I, j,
yes, that's what it would be. Yes.
I think if you used something other than the Kronecker delta, that would contribute to the tensor part.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you have to do it with the scalar, right? I mean, if you can't use another tensor here.
Why not?
Well, because then this whole thing wouldn't be made out of scalars only. See, this is by definition the most general thing we can write down only with scalars at every point in time. Okay? If you allow yourself to use a tensor now, you can do other things, but that you will put in the next categories.
What are we include time derivatives in there again?
Well, we just do the decomposition spatially.
Okay.
At every point in time, we do this spatial decomposition there. So if we do the same thing now for with the requirements that we write down the most general metric perturbation that can be made out of vectors, vector fields, then this is what you obtain. You write down a vector field and contract it. I mean, this is a spatial vector field. And then you could have a vector field and differentiate it. This way you get two indices, which you can then contract, but you have to symmetrize it so that what you obtain fulfills the requirement that it corresponds to a symmetric metric tensor. And then, at the end, we're left with the rest. The rest is simply anything left over in the metric tensor that cannot be written either in this form or in the other form. So it's just anything that is some tensor field that is not of that shape. Now, remember that in the case of electromagnetism, we had that the curve part and the divergence obey these properties. And now, quite similarly, we have that those vector fields V and W obey those conditions. Explicitly, V by the XI of VI summed over V is equal to zero. And also, similarly, to the case of the curl field in electromagnetism, of which we know that the divergence is vanishing, the curl field, if you remember, was the leftover. We looked at the electric field and we said there's a part that derives from a scalar field, and there's a part that's the rest, and the rest had this property that its divergence vanished. And here, similarly, Hij describes the rest, anything that cannot be written as in terms of scalars and vector fields. And that too obeys a condition that's pretty similar to having no divergence.
Are those really easy to show?
Yeah, it's relatively straightforward. No, it's still three-dimensional here.
Yeah.
And you can use what we had from electromagnetism. If you remember, if you were in my class last term, you may remember that this condition here tells us that we're dealing with wide curvature. And that means the tracelessness of that. And that means that we are describing gravitational waves. So now that we have this decomposition of the metric, we can insert this into the echo. So we write the inflaton field as the classical inflaton field that is spatially homogeneous plus the perturbation, and the metric we write as the metric that's spatially homogeneous plus a perturbation. We assume that phi and gamma are small, and you put both into the action. And the full action was the Einstein action plus the Klein-Gordon action plus all the actions from other fields, which we assume are not playing a role in the very early universe. Now, if we put all of this, what we had above, you know, all of this, you know, ds t squared is this, the vector part is that, and the scalar part is all of this, you can write this as a huge 4x4 matrix with lots of entries. And those entries depend on scalar functions phi, psi, b, and e. And the vector fields v and w and the tensor field h. All of these are entries of the metric tensor now. So we can put this metric tensor now into the Einstein equation. And we also put the expansion of phi into the Einstein equation. So obviously, this relatively compact action will be much more ugly once we write it in terms of this expansion, in which case it will depend on all of those quantities here. Now, it's a huge calculation. It's a messy thing to simplify that then. It turns out that we don't have to live with all those terms, with all of those. In principle, one might think, well, there's just no other way. Any one of those could occur. And how can we constrain these things? So we should really work with all of them. Aren't they all degrees of freedom of the metric and of the inflaton field, and therefore to be quantized and contribute and so on? Not really. The occurrence of these terms can really be simplified. And the reason is a very subtle one. And to figure out exactly how to do what I'm going to explain to you now took about 15 or 20 years and a lot of incorrect papers until eventually the issue was settled. See, now that space is allowed to be curved, to have curvature fluctuations, there is no longer a preferred foliation of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces. If the universe, as we discussed before, is expanding everywhere with the same rate, and you know it has this Killing vector field, and you have just this homogeneity, then it is straightforward to choose a suitable time coordinate. And in our case, it was the conformal time coordinate. It corresponded to choosing space-like hypersurfaces such that at equal time, every point had expanded at the same amount. But if the space-time is no longer expanding at an equal rate everywhere, if it has curvature fluctuations, then a priori there is no unique or preferred choice for how we choose what means equal time, how we slice our space-time into equal time hypersurfaces. There's no unique way of interpreting what our eta, what our time variable should mean. Equal time means which slicing through space-time. The notion of conformal time and the notion of comoving coordinates is no longer unique. But the, no. There is no notion of equal time. There is no preferred notion of equal time. So,
and this is because the thing fluctuates. I mean,
yes.
I mean, it doesn't evolve unitarily.
Yes.
Everything is governed by probabilities.
No, that's not it. It's not a matter of probabilities. Even classically, if the space-time is inhomogeneously expanding, then there is no unique sense of simultaneity. There are many ways you can define simultaneity. But which way you define simultaneity, the choice of your coordinate system is the choice of simultaneity. And which choice you make will affect those functions above. It will affect the values of those functions. For fixed space-time fluctuating, how you slice the space-time will affect the values of those functions there. And it turns out that we can actually choose our space-like hypersurface and therefore the notion of equal time, and therefore our coordinate system, such that these functions here, well, nearly all of them, actually vanish or at least simplify. If you look up the literature, you will find that some authors make some choice, some authors make another choice. It's very similar to electromagnetism, where you can also choose what is called a gauge, to arrange for the A field and other fields to be this or that. You see, in electromagnetism, for example, the A field can be the gradient, the electric field could be the gradient of a scalar field, okay, of the potential. But if you add a constant to that potential, then you still get the electric field, the same electric field. That's just a very simple example of these things as well. They are just like the potential function for the electric field, because these are the functions whose derivatives then will produce the contributions to the metric. So it took on the order of 10 years, 10 or 20 years or so, to clarify this issue. And for detailed references, I'm referring you to those two papers, but one of you told me that they're not entirely satisfactory or easy to read, those papers. There are actually new textbooks in cosmology, for example, the one by Weinberg, another one by Mukhanov, in which, and Little and Leith, in which these issues are addressed. And I will put those references in this place in the lecture notes.
It could be used for projects.
No, I think that's too hard, actually. It's really messy. I wouldn't recommend it. You can do it, but I wouldn't recommend it at all.
No, but I'm talking about Weinberg.
Yes, there's a lot of interesting things that you could use for an essay, but I wouldn't recommend that particular issue for it. Now, the result of all of this is that for small inhomogeneities, for first-order perturbations, nearly all the inhomogeneities can be eliminated by a suitable choice of coordinates. Nearly all of those functions can be eliminated. Except there are two fields, or two degrees of freedom, if you like, which are coordinate system or gauge independent, which cannot be thrown away in this way. Namely, first of all, there is a spatially scalar field R, which is made out of phi and the gammas. This is something we expected. We expected that there is a degree of freedom which is an amalgamation of the inflaton field degree of freedom and some part of the metric degree of freedom. Remember, we said that when the inflaton field fluctuates, that means that the energy momentum tensor is fluctuating, and that means that the metric has to fluctuate. So that means that some fluctuations of the metric are not independent of the fluctuations of the inflaton field. So there is not going to be 2 degrees of freedom, one for the inflaton field and one inside the metric. No, there is going to be a pair of degrees of freedom, the inflaton field and the metric, which together form 1 degree of freedom. And that is the one. And it turns out to be a linear combination of this function psi, which you remember is part of the metric tensor's decomposition, and it's part of the metric tensor's scalar part. It's a scalar function that occurs in the first contribution to the metric. The linear combination of that and the perturbation of the inflaton field with this prefactor here. Prefactor is a known prefactor. There's no dynamics in this for our purposes, because we are already assuming that A naught and phi naught, the zero modes of the inflaton field and the zero modes of the curvature, have already been calculated. So we're assuming that these are fixed given functions of eta, the scale factor and the zero mode of the inflaton field.
So this is the coupled part. This is the part.
Yes, this is the part. Exactly. So we are not going to quantize psi, the degree of freedom in the scalar part of the metric. We're not going to quantize phi as such, the degree of freedom in the inflaton field. But instead, we are going to quantize this linear combination. You see, the outcome of that analysis was that you can't really separate the two. Strictly speaking, this means the following. If you have a fluctuation in this degree of freedom, you can always choose a foliation of your spacetime in such a way that this vanishes, that the metric is not fluctuating at all. I mean, this scalar part of the metric is not fluctuating at all. You just choose your time coordinate. You choose your coordinate system in such a way that whenever there is a fluctuation in the metric, you're just going around it, so to speak, so that you're always at the same curvature level. So you don't see any curvature fluctuations as you go through the space-time. You're just choosing your space and time coordinates in such a way that at equal time, you're going this way through your space-time to slice it, that that you're always encountering the same scalar curvature. So all of the fluctuation is in phi. But you could also do the opposite. You could always you always choose your coordinate system in such a way that at equal time, the inflaton field is not varying at all. Instead, it's only the metric that's varying. Right? So you can always choose your space-like hypersurfaces in such a way that equal time is equal phi value. Okay? And this way, you never have any fluctuations in phi, because you choose your equal time values, your equal time as equal phi value. That gives you space-like hypersurfaces as well. So then all the fluctuations are in psi, in the scalar part of the metric. Maybe I should spell this out again. Remember, we decomposed the metric into three parts, scalar part, vector part, and tensor part. The scalar part has a lot of scalar functions in it, but by suitably choosing your space-like hypersurfaces, you can make all of them vanish except for this one. And then we said, just a moment, and then we said that on top of that, you can also choose your space-like hypersurfaces, that even this one is vanishing. And then you have fluctuations in that, but not in this. But you can also choose alternatively your space-like hypersurfaces in such a way that equal time means equal phi. So this is vanishing, and all the fluctuations are in this. So strategically, once we know, because fortunately some other folks have done a lot of work and found out that this thing, this linear combination, is the same value no matter what space-like hypersurfaces you choose. Okay, this is the gauge invariant quantity. This thing is independent of how you choose your space-like hypersurfaces. Then you work with this. You recognize that this whole thing is a true degree of freedom. This is the one you should quantize, this linear combination. And not worry about whether this fluctuates or that fluctuates. It's really this thing that fluctuates. So we are separating coordinate system choices from true degrees of freedom. These two things have a degree of freedom, but together only one, because they're coupled to the Einstein equation. And that one degree of freedom that they share is this one. Anybody?
Part.
You want to see the thing? Okay. Thank it's you. The very first there. Where are we?
The very first.
Let's see. Yeah. The one that I was wondering about. Yeah, so not this one. It's that one. Twice. So in fact, we can actually get rid of all these by choosing the space-like hypersurfaces suitably. And in fact, we could even get rid of this one.
Thank you.
This will come up later again. This issue of choosing space-like hypersurfaces suitably. So please don't forget about that. All right, so what we find is that this is the true degree of freedom. Those two, this, the inflaton field and the scalar part of the metric, together share one degree of freedom. The two of them are coupled by the Einstein equation, and so instead of having 2 degrees of freedom with one Einstein equation linking them, really we have only 1 degree of freedom that is not constrained by any equation. I mean, not constrained, but of course it is going to evolve with some dynamics. We're going to quantize this one. And what one can show is that that R of x and eta is also what is called the intrinsic curvature of the manifold. And that is, roughly speaking, how much the manifold is bloated. If you view it in such a way that you don't have fluctuations in the inflaton field, but only fluctuations in the curvature, then you can interpret this as the amount by which the space-time is so to speak, bloated, is a little bit blown up. You see, the space-time can be, you can do two things with space-time. You can locally shrink or blow it up, or you can distort it. Just like, I don't know, a membrane or so. You can always, you know, put a dent in it by making it thinner or compressing it and so on. But you can also, you know, hold on to it like this and then turn it a bit. And this is the scalar part. The scalar part is just the scalar bloating of it. Yeah, and then secondly, we have a spatial tensor field. That's another degree of freedom in this. And that is the Hij. This thing cannot be gotten rid of by choosing the space-like hypersurfaces suitably. And Hij represents T mu nu energy momentum tensor independent degrees of freedom, while curvature, gravitational waves. It measures how much space is locally distorted against itself. So this is the idea of, you know, tweaking a membrane. That's just what I told you. Now, vector inhomogeneities can be considered as well, but it turns out that in the calculation that follows, the vector inhomogeneities will not have an interesting dynamics. They will not have a dynamics which leads to an amplification of the quantum fluctuations. So in principle, vector fluctuations could be there, but we do not expect them to be large. They should still behave just like in Minkowski space, even though there is an expansion. So we will not worry about the vector fluctuation. Even though I should put as a disclaimer that it's not entirely clear that the vector fluctuation really behave this way and are completely unaffected by the expansion. And that's just a generic disclaimer I have to put, because we don't really know fundamentally what modes are doing when they just before they cross the Hubble horizon. Remember that the Hubble horizon is only about 5 or 6 orders of magnitude larger than the Planck length. But this means that just before a mode crosses the Hubble horizon, it must have been much smaller. Its wavelength would have been smaller than the Hubble length. And not long before the mode crosses the Hubble horizon, it would have been as small as the Planck length, or smaller. I mean, mathematically, this is what we calculate. We calculate as if the wavelength were smaller than the Planck length. And that is questionable. It's not clear that we are allowed to do this. And the general point of view on this issue is that, well, some people don't care. maybe they're not aware of the fact that the Planck scale gravity should be very nonlinear, very dominant. But others would say that whatever happens at the Planck scale, modes arise from the Planck scale in the usual form, in the usual Minkowski configuration, let's say, in the Minkowski vacuum state. But that is not entirely trivial. And you know, one of the essay topics, possible essay topics, is to look at that question. And it's not clear to me, at least, whether it couldn't happen that the vector part is somehow affected by Planck scale physics and would be in a non-trivial vacuum state and therefore would contribute. It depends on what assumptions we make for Planck scale physics. Okay, but in this course, we are not making any assumptions about Planck scale physics. All right, so let us look at the expanded action now. This is the action. We expanded it in terms of the metric and the inflaton field. And we do that. We do the expansion to second order in the inhomogeneities in order to obtain their lowest order, namely the linear equations of motion. We will get a scalar action, an action for the scalar part, for this R field, and an action for the tensor part. Remember, the R field was that linear combination of the metric and the inflaton field, of the scalar part of the metric and the inflaton field, the gauge invariant degree of freedom that they share. Now, the scalar part, this R field, which is also called the Mukhanov variable, That field has then this action. So this is what happens if you expand the full action that we had up there up to second order in the perturbations. And you see here that you basically get something like a Klein-Gordon action. But it's not quite the Klein-Gordon action. The Klein-Gordon action, well, can you tell how the Klein-Gordon action would look like? If R was a Klein-Gordon field, what would be the action? How would it differ from that action? Remember that here we have the Minkowski metric, and then we have here the derivatives of the R. And if this were A squared, then we would have A squared times the Minkowski metric, that is the full metric, and we just have the d mu of the scalar field. So that would be the action of a Klein-Gordon field R if it has no mass. Right? No mass term here. So if only this were not z of eta, whatever z is, we will get it in a moment, if this were A squared of eta, then R would be simply a scalar field obeying the Klein-Gordon equation. But now, z of eta, this comes out of this very lengthy calculation, is a naught squared of eta over a naught prime of eta times phi naught prime of eta. Completely known function of eta. Because we are assuming here that we have already solved the classical problem for the zero mode of the inflaton field and of the metric. So what this means is that R is not a scalar field that obeys the usual Klein-Gordon equation on our spacetime. But it is as good as if. And the reason is that mathematically, this is exactly the action of a Klein-Gordon field, except that it's the action of a Klein-Gordon field on a spacetime described by a scale factor z instead of a scale factor a. But as far as the mathematics is concerned, it's just a different name, whether we call it a or z. It's just a given function of eta. Therefore, all of our technology still applies, and we will be able to calculate the quantum theory of that scalar field. Scalar, massless, real field. Where what used to be the scale factor is replaced by this somewhat more complicated function here. And it turns out that it's not very much different from A in general. And the reason is that, you see, during inflation, A naught of eta is exponential. Now, in slow roll inflation, it's not exactly exponential, but it's nearly exponential. Because the potential is decaying, that means that the temporary cosmological constant that the potential represents is decaying, which means that the Hubble radius is increasing slowly. The Hubble constant is decreasing slowly. So it's not quite exponential, but nearly so. And that means that A naught is nearly proportional to A prime, right? Because that's what exponential means. A is proportional to A prime. So really, we nearly have a cancellation of one of those A naught squares with the A naught prime. So we're just left with an A naught, okay? And this thing shouldn't change much over time because it's slow roll. Okay, so basically we are still having here an A naught of eta. It's just a little bit of a change. But it's not completely different. As if you're close to exponential, this is close to A of eta. And this also means that even the horizon crossing is going to happen pretty much at the same time as if this were an A of eta, as long as the expansion is nearly exponential. So this action for R is very similar to the standard action of a Klein-Gordon field on an expanding spacetime, except that A of eta is replaced by Z of eta. Okay, we just said that. Now, let us look at the tensor part. Remember, we have 2 degrees of freedom. We have the R field up there. It is a linear combination of the scalar part of the metric, the psi, and the inflaton field perturbation, which together share 1 degree of freedom, which is R, gauge invariant degree of freedom. And then, after making use of the fact that we can choose our slicing of space-time in suitable ways, we found that nothing else contributes in the metric. All the other vector functions and so on can be put equal to zero, except that the hij can't be influenced. This is always going to be there. We can't get rid of this. So this is an independent degree of freedom that the metric has, an independent degree of freedom by which it can fluctuate. We should quantize this as well, or this matrix as well. Now, from the expansion of the full action to second-order interperturbations, we obtain that the action of this tensor part of the metric is this. And let us look at how this compares to a Klein-Gordon action. It, in fact, is a Klein-Gordon action. See, for every ij, this is a regular Klein-Gordon action. It's a scale factor squared times eta mu nu, which is the regular Klein-Gordon metric, the regular metric, and then it's just the derivatives of h, derivative of h contracted over mu and nu. It's just the usual thing, and that's true for every I and for every j. So we have here a bunch of Klein-Gordon fields, even with the usual scale factor. So we should be able to solve this right away. So what we have to do is quantize both the r and the hijs, the scalar fluctuations made up in equal parts of the scalar part of the metric and the inflaton field and the tensor part of the metric. This is a pure quantum gravity effect. This is a mixed quantum gravity and quantum inflaton effect. So the equations of motion come then out to be this. The equations of motion for the tensor part are just the usual equations of motion for any Klein-Gordon field on an expanding space-time, because it is just the usual action. Okay? Just this is the Euler Lagrange equation for the usual action. Now, what is the equation of motion for the scalar part? Well, it's the same thing, except that A is replaced by Z. Okay? It's just the usual equation of motion. So what we'll have to do is quantize those two equations of motion.
Yes,
that's right. Actually, the hij has to be symmetric. It won't have many degrees of freedom. We will have to find out exactly what they are. Okay, so what is our strategy going to be? Well, as we did earlier on in the course, we will define auxiliary fields such that there will be no friction terms. Remember, these are the equations of motion, the Klein-Gordon equations, with friction terms. Right? Like the harmonic oscillator, but friction terms. Remember, we know how to fix this by changing to a new field variable, which differs from the old one just by a factor of the scale factor. And down here, we can do it simply by multiplying the scale factor A, and up here, we will be able to get rid of the friction term by changing to a new variable, which differs from the original one by a factor of Z. So remember what we did before in the course. Phi, the original Klein-Gordon field, obeys the Klein-Gordon equation, which has a friction term on expanding spacetime. But A times phi, the chi field, obeys the Klein-Gordon equation without a friction term. Maybe this one. Now, similarly here, we look at the scalar degree of freedom, you know, the thing that's made up of the scalar part of the metric and inflaton field. If we multiply it with the not the scale factor, but the z that occurs in its action and in its equation of motion, then we obtain this variable u here, which again obeys an equation of motion without a friction term. The minus sign here doesn't do any harm. You know, here we didn't put a minus sign in here, but it is convenient to put a minus sign in there. It's a trivial convenience factor. Okay, so that means that this variable r, the scalar part of the curvature, the local bloating of the space-time, if you slice your space-time at equal phi values, then this variable u that you derive from it obeys this Klein-Gordon equation without a friction term, which is exactly of the type that we solved before. Then the tensor components are even easier. Instead of hij, which has a friction term, we multiply with a of eta, multiply with this convenience factor here, and then get degrees of freedom pij. And they obey the equation of motion without a friction term.
Is there a reason to have the I on the upper limits?
Nope. Sorry. You can put that down. I don't know how that happened. Thanks. Okay, so our goal now is to quantize u hat and p hat, and then from that, calculate what the fluctuations are in u and the fluctuations in p, which tells us what the fluctuations are in r and the fluctuations in h. Well, what the fluctuations are after horizon crossing. Right? I mean, once they have crossed the horizon, the size of the fluctuations doesn't change anymore. Okay, so that is what we will calculate next. So we've set it all up, and what we need to do next time only is to actually carry this out. We carry out the calculations that we already did in the last lecture, but now plugging in these fields, and for the scalar part in particular, we will replace the A by the Z. But other than that, it's all pretty straightforward. And the implications will be, just to preview this, that the fluctuations of the R field will give us local space-time expansion or contraction, and therefore a local heating or cooling, a local, after inflation ends and all the energy in the inflaton field has turned into the creation of new particles, a very hot gas of new particles, then those fluctuations in R will translate into a slightly elevated temperature of that plasma, or a slightly diminished temperature of that plasma locally. And the fluctuations of those temperatures we can then calculate. And the fluctuations of H, of the tensor part of the metric, will give us gravitational fields, a gravitational field background. And whereas the temperature fluctuations in the primordial plasma are assumed to be seen now in the temperature fluctuations of the cosmic microwave background, where I should say that not directly. After inflation ended, the plasma underwent about 100,000 years of evolution as a plasma until it cooled down so much that the electrons and the protons stuck together and the whole thing turned from a plasma into a gas, and hydrogen gas is transparent. So from then onwards, the light was liberated, and that's the light that we see now. So what we see is what came off these temperature fluctuations after 100,000 years of plasma physics. But this plasma physics is thought to be completely understood. So you can take the calculations that we did, plug them into computer programs, and they will calculate for you what the temperature spectrum should then be after the 100,000 years of plasma physics, and that also tells you what temperature distribution you should see on the sky. So while that is the observational effect of fluctuations in R, the observational consequences of fluctuations in H are expected to be fluctuations in the polarization of the light from the cosmic microwave background. The Planck satellite was launched, and it is going to try to measure the polarization spectrum of the cosmic microwave background. It has been measured before, but not with much precision, and Planck tries to improve on that, so that you end up with essentially a vector field in the sky. Because at every point you have a polarization of the radiation, and in this vector field, you can decompose into a gradient field and a curl part. And the gradient field has several contributions from all sorts of physical effects. But the curl part, apparently, is nearly completely generated only by that. So it could be that the Planck satellite will see this curl part of the cosmic microwave background's polarization fluctuations, and that would be a measurement of H. So it would be the first measurement of gravitational waves, actually.
Do you have a time estimate about when these might be coming out?
I don't know. I don't know. Obviously, if it's a positive measurement, they will try to put it out as quickly as possible, and they don't want to be wrong. So I don't know. Maybe a year or so. I heard that if Planck doesn't find them, there are plans underway to launch a satellite in a few years' time that is dedicated to only measuring the polarization. Planck is measuring all sorts of things. So it's not really dedicated for that particular thing. But then there would be a satellite that measures only the polarization. And well, it could still take a few years, but it would be amazing. It could be that in this way, gravitational waves are actually detected before any other way.
Also, do we have one or two more lectures left?
Okay. Well, let's just end the lecture for now. And you know, for the cameraman, I think you can stop now.